The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just, and it also will be more compassionate. I am Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the Church in the world. We've kind of now entered into March, and March is Women's History Month. So today on Just Love, we're going to be discussing issues surrounding women in the workplace. Today, we know women are graduating college at higher rates and earning higher wages than in previous decades, but there still is a lot of talk about the gender gap, the gender wage gap, and that reality we're going to discuss today in a couple of ways with our guests. And, you know, some are suggesting that maybe it's going to disappear as educated women progress in their careers. Others attribute it to a lack of opportunity. And so today we'll be speaking with our first guest in a little bit about how today's young women seemingly outperform male peers in both work and life. Boy, I wonder who's judging that one, whether that's happening. And then later on, our second guest will explain how kind of the, some of the statistics of how we look at the earning power and how we kind of figure out what's going on with regard to that. So thank you for kind of tuning into Just Love this week and being with us. But before we go to our guests, Tom, is there any news that you kind of want to share with our listeners to start off our show?
Sure, Monsignor. Well, you know, I mean, this is the beginning of March, and as always, it usually happens.
So what do we think? Is it coming in as a lamb, leaving as a lion? What's all that stuff about?
Well, I have a feel. I mean, at least I think locally, March is coming in a little bit like a lamb, which I think is good. I mean, I think it's always good when it comes in gently, but I worry a little bit down the line what's going to wind up happening.
Did you know I was just watching the news? I'm just feel like interrupting you today.
It's okay.
But I watched the news. This is, I think, the second warmest winter in the New York metropolitan area ever.
Really?
That's
wow.
What
okay.
I, you know, maybe I wasn't paying attention, but it certainly seemed warm. Actually, this was my favorite winter of all time.
How come?
I'll tell you why it was okay. My favorite winter, okay? Because I love snow.
Okay.
Okay? And in the New York metropolitan area, we got the mostest snow ever. Well, not exactly. We were like a tenth of an inch below the most.
Okay.
But I'm counting it. Okay, I'm adding for good credit. I'm giving them an extra.
Okay,
so we
we'll
got
do that.
We got the most snow ever in a single day, almost, and it was gone 3 days later because it got to be warm, and we had a week or so of really really cold weather. So we get credit for being winter,
right?
But the rest of it was kind of mild. So my kind of winter.
I know, Monsieur, I totally agree with you, but that's when you mentioned before about coming in like a lion or a lamb. I'm worried because, you know, it came in like a lamb, and you know what they sometimes say. So are we going to get clobbered, do you think?
No.
I was going to say, that's
kinda,
my only concern.
It's moving towards spring. We're
going to think positive
right.
thoughts. That's
okay.
Good. That's the way we should.
Okay.
And just as far as the month of March goes, you know, at the very beginning, what always winds up happening is Pope Francis always puts out his prayer intention. And interestingly, this month—
The Pope only prays in March?
Well, I think the Pope prays all the time.
Oh, good. Okay, I'm good.
But I think, but what this intention
especially
is—
especially better because it's Lent.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
He better pray and fast and
I hope he's praying for me because I pray for him every day at Mass.
That's right. Yes, we all do. That's
we
true.
Do.
We do. We do. We do end up praying. We do end up praying for him. But he asked us if we can. I would say if we would keep in mind this is his intention for the universal intention for evangelization, that those Christians who on account of their faith are discriminated against or being persecuted in parts of the world remain strong and faithful to the gospel. And thanks to the incessant prayer of the church. So he's asking us to keep those Christians in mind.
You know, Tom, let me just talk a little bit about that, because that is an issue which is very, very painful in so many ways that, boy, I think, at least in my world that I look at, there wasn't a whole lot of persecutions of Christians that I'm aware of in, you know, in modern time, you know, in the contemporary world. And sure, there are people who tried to challenge some of the ways that Christians lived, and there were ways that challenged our values by society. But the actual persecution of Christians, I think, was pretty rare. However, in the past decades or so, there has been an increased presence of the persecutions of Christians. And, you know, people are now asking us to pay attention to it and to make sure that we raise it up, because if we don't raise it up, then we can't do anything about it. And I think it's important to raise it up. And as we all know, Tom, we should never be hesitant to say when people are persecuting people for their religion, when they're persecuting Christians and others. But just because we're Christians, we shouldn't be prohibited from raising up the fact that our fellow Christians in other parts of the world are being persecuted. And so I think it's important that we do that.
Absolutely. And, you know, I interestingly enough, Monsignor, you know, right now the Knights of Columbus are actually calling on people around the country to join them in an online petition. They're actually campaigning to ask Secretary of State John Kerry to declare that what's going on in the Middle East regarding Christians is indeed a genocide. They have a website that they ask you to go to. It's called www.stopthechristiangenocide.org. No spaces between those words. And they're asking people to go on before March 17th, which is the deadline Congress has imposed on Secretary Kerry, to give a report on what's going on and really to talk a little bit about what's going on vis-a-vis Christians in Iraq, in Syria, and also other minorities such as the Yazidis that are being oppressed by forces over in the Middle East such as ISIS.
So now let me give you a little bit of kind of personal and policy history, okay? Did you know, Tom, and did I wonder if our listeners know, that the United States publishes each year a report on religious persecution throughout the world?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they kind of document the persecution of various groups in different countries, and they classify them as being highly persecuted, not highly persecuted, etc. And that goes back, I think, probably 20 or so years. I'm not exactly sure when it began, but I can tell you that I testified before Congress.
Wow.
When the Senate Judiciary Committee, when that legislation was being proposed.
Oh, wow.
So,
that's very cool.
I remember that, you know, rather well. And periodically, I look at the report. So it's it is something that is pretty important. It's something that we need to raise up. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it's a critically important thing, because we believe that the right to worship is one of those fundamental human rights. So first of all, people should be allowed to worship, but certainly even more so, people shouldn't be killed. They can't be killed. Well, they can be, but they shouldn't be killed simply because they profess a religious belief that is not the predominant religious belief in the area in which they are living. So anyway, Tom, thank you for mentioning that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's time, since it is Women's History Month, let's go to our topic of the day and talk about some pay issues, gender issues, some family issues with regard to men and women and children. I'm delighted that we have as our first guest Kay Himowitz, who is the William E. Simon Fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a contributing editor of City Journal. Kay, thank you so much for being with us on Just Love today.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
Great. So tell me, how'd you get all interested in this particular, the topics that you write about?
Well, I started writing when my children were young, and this was quite some time ago. And I noticed that people, my peers, were very different kinds of parents than our own parents had been. And I think I was noticing a very profound cultural change in the relation between adults and children. This was in the 1980s that I was observing this. And that led me to write about children in a number of publications. And then I got interested, naturally enough, in families because that's where children get their real education. So that's how I found myself where I am.
You know, Kay, let me share with you a little bit of my personal perspective on just one little thing. For many, many years, I lived in the Upper West Side neighborhood of Manhattan. And one of the things that I observed, and observed with such a great deal of joy, periodically you'd get a mother and a child, or a father and a child. Didn't make any difference. And they'd be walking down the streets, and they'd have to be alone. And I would just eavesdrop on the incredibly fun conversations that they were having. Sometimes they were nonsense, in which, like, the kid was saying things that a kid would say and the mom was trying to figure it out. But other times, sometimes the kid was talking about pretty adult conversations and the parent was responding in a very adult way to the child. And I have to, a little bit of a confession, I would oftentimes kind of adjust the pace of my walking down the street so that I could continue to be in earshot, because I was just so taken back by the conversation. And to your point, Kay, you know, I think we probably saw more of that then or now than we may have seen a generation or two ago.
Absolutely. That was, you're describing a very nice part of the of these changes that I described in my first book, Ready or Not. And I think that there was this less of a generation gap between the parents and children, and higher expectations that children could be rational, intelligent creatures. And as I try to point out in the book, quite some time ago already, that has good points and bad points. The good point, and this elaborates on your idea, is that for now that my children are grown, and this is true for all of my peers, we are just amazed at how close we are to our adult children, much more so than we ourselves were to our own parents. So that speaks of a certain kind of intimacy and closeness that is possible now. The downside is that sometimes we're inclined to think kids are smarter and cleverer than they actually are.
I mean, cut you over, because let me share something. As wonderful as my eavesdropping and my observation is, you know, every now and then I'm looking at one of those conversations and the parent says something that might make some sense to somebody who's 65.
Yeah.
And I look at the expression on the kid's face where the kid is saying, "What's that all about?" It's like, yes, you can treat kids like little people, but they're still little people, not grown-up people.
Yeah, and slow to understand the world. And I think there's a tendency now, and maybe it's partly technology and we can't really control this, there's a tendency to sort of assume that kids are just going to be able to handle a lot of information that in the old days used to be meted out just a little bit at a time. Like I said, it may be that parents just don't have control over the information coming into their homes, into the schools in a way that they used to. But nevertheless, it has its downsides, as I say.
You know, can we go a generation forward in what they refer to? I think sometimes today I've heard the expression kind of helicopter parents with regard to, I guess, the current age of kids who are beginning college or something. Is that another change that's going on that you're observing?
Yeah, it is, although this is somewhat class-based. That is, the helicoptering that we hear so much about is pretty much a middle-class phenomenon. It is not to be found in poorer communities in quite the same way, although it depends on the community. I mean, I've done some work on the Chinese, very poor Chinese in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. They're not helicopter parents, but they are tiger parents.
Okay.
So
yeah.
Right. It's a slightly different model. But at any rate, the helicoptering that goes on, again, it's a kind of mixed bag, I would say. On the one hand, we all know the downsides. I mean, we're all rolling our eyes at the parents who won't let their kids suffer any failure and learn about hard knocks. I've been hearing now about parents who are actually calling their kids bosses. Grown right. kids' bosses to complain about various problems. That inability to let their kids just grow up and deal with life as it really is one downside of it. The upside is that helicopter parents are often very attuned to the strengths and weaknesses of their children. Yeah, they want to overcompensate for the weaknesses, but they also might be more cognizant of what it is their kids enjoy and what they're good at, and pursue those interests if they're being smart about it.
You know, and from a again a positive point of view, from the other point of view, what I've observed a little bit is that the, you know, that generation, I guess, is that millennials that we're talking about now?
Yes.
Yeah. Is that, you know, is that they want to stay in touch with their parents, even if they're out of school, or, you know, they almost consider their parents as kind of, you know, a big sister or a big brother or a big friend, you know, an older friend, in kind of wanting to share what's going on, you know, in their life almost every day, at least a little bit of my observation.
Oh, absolutely. That's part of, that's the other side of the helicoptering. The
right.
Kids are not, you know, they're used to this kind of closeness and supervision from their parents. And when they go to college, those who are lucky enough to do so, they're texting, calling. I mean, I was amazed how much my daughter, my youngest daughter, who really was the most part of this new kind of parenting or exposed to it the most with her own friends, was always annoyed with us for not calling more often when she was in college. Well,
right.
I don't know. Excuse me. I sort of thought that was the way it was supposed to be.
Well, it is. So, listen, we're speaking with Kay Himowitz, who is a fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a contributing editor of City Journal. Now, it is Women's History Month, but I got to ask you, how did the rise of women turn us men into boys?
Well, let me just say you're giving a nice plug to my most recent book, which is actually a few years old now, called Manning Up. And what I try to show in that book is that there women have done quite well in this new economy. They are, you know, in the old days when there was a lot more brawn and strength required in a lot of jobs, it wasn't such a woman's world. Now, for educated women in particular, there are so many opportunities to express their women's, you know, women's strengths. So, for instance, there are more and more jobs that require interpersonal skills, and perhaps this is a very old-fashioned way of thinking about this, but women tend to be a little bit better at that than men. Unfortunately,
my experience, Kay, is that women tend to be a little bit better at almost anything than men. That's my experience.
Well, I wouldn't want to say that in the present company.
Right.
But at any rate, they're doing quite well. They do extremely well in school, and they always have, by the way. So now about over 57% of our college graduates are women. And that is something new, although women have always done well in school. They have never graduated college in these numbers as they are today. They're doing quite well in the workplace. At least say in the early years, once they have children, things change a little bit. But the success of women, I think, has thrown the relations between the sexes into a bit of confusion, particularly for millennials, for the younger generation who are not yet settled. The dating scene is very confused. I mean, how do you take a woman out for dinner if she's making more money than you are?
You let her pay.
Yeah.
That's
Well, that's what a lot of guys say.
Right.
And a lot of women don't say that.
And you make sure it's an expensive restaurant.
Yeah.
That's
But these rule, you know, the old-fashioned dating was one of the reasons it's disappearing, is because of the new role of women and the new and their success, in, as I say, in this economy and in the schools as well. So it's no longer makes sense to think of a guy as asking a woman out and then paying for her and so on and so forth. And the problem again is that the scripts that people relied on for courting, for dating, are gone. So everybody's trying to figure it out, you know, figure the, these things out for themselves and making their own rules as they go along. And it, you can see that there have been some problems associated with that.
So, again, I like the title of your of the book, but in a maybe a little bit more serious or analytical way, has it kind of caused some of an emotional immaturity in men in trying to deal with that?
I think that for men, especially in their early 20s, there's a kind of immaturity that a lot of women in particular are complaining about. Now, maybe 22, 23-year-old men were always immature. The difference is that in the past, they married at these young ages, and that forced them to confront real life and mature situations in a way that they don't have to today. So they can hang out with their buddies and put up their Star Wars posters in their studio apartments or in their shared apartments and live the life of a kind of advanced teenager. They have to have a job or they're going to graduate school maybe or something like that. But their social experience is very, very different than it would have been, let's say, in the 1960s even.
Hmm. That is interesting. And I think the statistics that indicate, boy, the incredible growth since the 1970s of the number of people in their late 20s who are still unmarried.
Right. So, yeah, that's one of the main themes in Manning Up, that the delayed marriage is really complicated. A lot of the ideas about maturation and the ideas about what it is to be an adult. There are many good things that have come along with later marriage, particularly for educated folks, but there are also some real new dilemmas that they're dealing with you probably have even witnessed without quite realizing it.
You know, and let me throw another factor in the equation is, again, going back a generation or two, it would not have been uncommon for somebody to have, you know, 1, 2, 3 jobs maybe over their career. You know, between the time of, let's say, their early 20s to their retirement in their 60s. Nowadays, I'm told on average that a college graduate in the past 4 or 5 years will probably have 16 different jobs by the time they retire. And it seems to me the changing of a job with, at least in this economy market, which oftentimes a little bit of a gap between a new job occurs, I bet you that's got some impact on maturing.
That's such a good point. What happens is that for a lot of young people who are setting out on their, you know, the first rungs of their career, one reason that they don't even consider marriage is because they know that their career is going to be unstable for a long time. And that's if they're lucky. It could remain unstable. But they will probably be moving jobs. They may have to move into a different city. They may have to move to a different country, you know.
Yeah.
So that makes it harder to think about settling down. And because both men and women are organizing their 20s around their careers, that makes it even harder, because if you're already married and your boss wants you to move for 2 years to London or something, and your wife life's boss does not. You've got real problems, yeah. Right? So,
well, it's funny. There was an article someplace in the past 5 or 8 years that was kind of pushing white collar women to marry blue collar men, because therefore they wouldn't be in the same economic stream, and therefore since the white collar woman was expected to earn more, she could go wherever she wanted and the blue collar husband would have to follow. Now, it was just an article which I found fun to read. I don't know if it had any reality, but it was kind of an interesting piece.
Well, there are a larger number of couples where the wife is making more than the husband.
Yeah.
It's still, quite a bit. It's a little.
It's not common.
Unusual, yeah. But it is happening, and there's a lot of research going on right now to figure out whether those relationships are working out well. And there's some concern that those couples are more likely to encounter problems down the line.
Yeah. Hey, thank you. This was fascinating. I'm absolutely delighted. And thank you for writing and exploring this topic. I think it's really, really fascinating. I think it's very, very interesting. I know I learned a lot from you, and I'm certain that our listeners did. So, Kay, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, I really enjoyed it.
Good. Kay Himelitz, the William E. Simon Fellow of the Manhattan Institute and a contributing editor of City Journal. We've been talking about gender issues because it's Women's History Month. And so we're discussing women in the workplace, women in the family, delayed marriages. And when we come back in just a few minutes, we'll go to our second guest, who will talk a little bit more about the economics of it and some gender wage gap, which we've been talking about. So join us when we come back in just a couple of minutes on Just Love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself. Our world will be more just and more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world, and it's Women's History Month. So we've been discussing issues surrounding women in the workplace, gender issues with regard to relationships, and some are suggesting that maybe the gender gap might disappear with regard to wages as educated women progress in their careers. And so we've been talking about it, and we're going to talk more about it in kind of our next segment about how we look at how those wages issues work themselves out. Tom, any other news you want to share with our listeners?
Sure, Monsieur. This week, actually, marks kind of an interesting anniversary for some of the topics we talk about here on Just Love. Back on March 1st, we celebrated the 55th anniversary of the founding of the Peace Corps by President John F. Kennedy.
Ah.
Yes, back on March 1st, 1961. And he did so by executive order. And then in September, at that point, the Congress backed the president's initiative by providing $40 million then, which is $1.2 billion in today's money, for initial appropriation for the program. And Kennedy said he wanted the Peace Corps to be an army of civilians who would volunteer their time and skills to help underdeveloped nations raise their living standards around the world. And he said it was important because our own freedoms and the future of freedom around the world depends in a very real sense on the ability to build growing and independent nations where men can live in dignity, liberated from the bonds of hunger, ignorance, and poverty.
Okay, so that was pretty good. Mm-hmm. That was pretty good. So how many years ago was that?
It was 55 years ago.
Okay.
If you can imagine, yeah. So,
wow.
It was a while.
That is good. So what else is new?
In a related issue, Monsignor, now it's kind of interesting. One of the places that was one of the first places where the Peace Corps sent people is the country of Ethiopia. And actually, in Ethiopia, recently there have been a tremendous drought. And there's been two consecutive crop failures. And as a result of that, Ethiopia, which is a nation of 96 million people, is preparing to confront a massive food crisis. On ordinary circumstances, and I've been actually with Catholic Relief Services to Ethiopia, Monsignor, we saw this. On a regular basis, people in Ethiopia face, about 10 million of them face kind of hunger per year. But now the number has raised up to 18 million. And the severity of the drought has caused people to up and leave and abandon their villages, mostly in the north, to walk south to less severely affected areas. And that has sparked a lot of conflict in the area. So
let me say, here's what I want to encourage our listeners. Now, we know that we want to encourage our listeners to listen to every single show on the Catholic Channel because they're just so wonderful. They are so good. Every now and then, however, if there may be a repeat or it's being a replay or best of, and you've heard it before, I want to suggest that you go to BBC. Okay? And I don't remember the number. Here's why I want you to go to BBC. And you can also watch it on television, too. Because, sadly, most of our American media doesn't cover what's going on in Africa, in Asia, with any type of frequency, certainly not with any depth. And BBC, on the other hand, does. Now, this is I never heard anybody say this, but here's why I think. You know why I think BBC covers those places?
No.
They're still pretending, because they're still pretending they're part of the empire. But
I think you're right.
Because BBC is, British Broadcasting Company. But they do some very, very good stuff on what's going on in those places. What's going on in famine, what's going on in politics, on civic stuff in those countries. So I encourage our listeners to kind of just, tune into that periodically because you get a feel for other parts of the world. Now, maybe I need to do a little bit more of that for Lent because I used to listen a little more. I just haven't been doing it. But you do learn things that we just don't cover in the American media. So why do I say that? I say that because this famine in Ethiopia, which is pretty significant, mm-hmm. I was unaware of till Tom, you brought it to my attention. And I'm willing to bet that there might have been one or two of our listeners out there that wasn't aware of it either.
Yeah. And, the problem is, and actually Catholic Relief Services has been in Ethiopia for at least 50 years, working with the Ethiopian government and with the local Ethiopian church in the areas of emergency food assistance and agriculture and sanitation and water. And in actually fiscal year 2014, which is the last one they actually monitored, they helped over 3 million people in Ethiopia with all of those areas. And Monsignor, I can tell you, I was actually in the area of Ethiopia that is experiencing famine. And we went up to that area in Diridawa, which is off towards where Somalia is. And the number of food huts or food, I guess, tents where the food is kept is enormous. And they keep stocks there of oil and of corn and of grain in the event of these crises coming up. So they know that Ethiopia is a food insecure area. So they're always preparing for it. But this drought is significant. This is a very, very serious one. And we'll probably be hearing more about this in the news in coming weeks and months.
Well, that is good. And I think, you know, again, it's good. We just, Tom, just for your information, we just finished, as you know, and for our listeners, while Ethiopia is just a tremendous situation in other parts of the world, we still have hunger in the United States. And so we finished in New York and Catholic Charities our Feeding Our Neighbor campaign, in which we have been striving to raise over a million additional meals for food pantries and soup kitchens in the metropolitan area. We're on our way to do it. It takes a while to kind of count up all the food and donations that come in. But I think we're very much on the way to kind of hitting our million meal target. So I think that's pretty important.
Excellent.
You know what, Tom? I think we'll take a guest and take a break, rather. And when we come back, we'll speak with our second guest, who is Sarah Jane Glynn, who is the director of the Women's Economic Policy under the Center for American Progress. This is Just Love, Just Do It. Just love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just. It will be more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a moment or two on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. And since it's Women's History Month, today on Just Love, we're discussing issues surrounding women in the workplace and gender issues with regard to wage, advancing in careers and families and all types of things like that. Now, I'm really happy to welcome as our next guest, Sarah Jane Glynn, who is the director of the Women's Economic Policy of women's economic policy under the Center for American Progress. Sarah, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Great. I am delighted that we're having the opportunity to talk about it. I got to begin. So what are you writing your doctoral dissertation on?
So my dissertation is actually about the service economy and how people use interactive service encounters as a way to construct social identity. So it's very different from the policy work that I do every day in my job in D.C.
You know, for our listeners, just so that they know, because that phrase is used a lot, the service industry. What does that mean? I mean, what falls into service industries?
So generally speaking, service jobs are ones where instead of just working with a product, you're working directly with a customer. So I think the clearest contrast is thinking about manufacturing, where, you know, you'd have somebody who was maybe working on an assembly line in a factory, and they would be making products that would eventually get to a consumer, but they weren't directly interacting with the consumer as part of their job. And you can contrast that to something like, you know, a person who works at Starbucks, for example. There's still a product involved. They're still making you that cup of coffee, but you have that face-to-face direct interaction, and that's the service component that makes this type of work unique.
How about an auditor or an accountant? Is that considered a service industry or no?
You know, according to the way that sociologists would classify things, and, you know, I myself am a sociologist, yes, we would count those as service jobs.
But there might be some ways that they did sectors of the economy where they wouldn't count that as a service industry?
Well, I think that the way that we popularly talk about the term, it tends to focus a little bit more on where you have those very direct face-to-face interactions. And the way that we popularly talk about service work is oftentimes also confined to jobs that tend to be a little bit lower wage. So jobs like food service or retail and things like that.
Okay, I got it. So thank you. Well, good luck. How far along are you in your dissertation?
You know, I'm almost done. I'm doing final edits, and I should be defending it hopefully within the next couple of months.
Yay.
Yeah,
that's
very
good.
Excited.
That's good. So let's go on to talk about what's going on in the economy, where it has to do with kind of women and wages and stuff like that. Give us an overview. So what's going on in that? I know that's a broad question, but I'm going to let you start wherever you want to start.
Well, thanks. You know, this is one of my favorite things to talk about, actually, and not just because I am, you know, a woman who also works for pay. But, you know, I think one thing that is really interesting about women in work, and I think most of your listeners will probably have experienced this in some way in their own lives, too, is that we've seen a really dramatic shift over the last 50 years or so. So it used to be that, you know, women were much less likely than men to be part of the paid labor force. You know, certainly there were always women who worked, immigrant women, women of color, working class women always held down jobs. But those, they tended to be jobs and not careers. And women, when they did work, oftentimes had pretty spotty work histories. So, you know, I like to think of my grandmother. When she was young, you know, she graduated from high school, she went to nursing school, she worked as a nurse for a few years, then she got married, quit working, stayed home to raise her six children, and then once her children were grown, she actually went back to work, right? But that was a very, very different pattern than, you know, women today tend to have, where women are more likely than men to go to college, and once they start working, they tend to continue working throughout their lives, and they're more likely to have careers as opposed to jobs. And part of this is just because our economy has changed. So, you know, families oftentimes need more money to get by. The cost of living has gone up. The essentials of a middle-class lifestyle have become more expensive over time. And so we've seen more and more women working, not just because it can be fulfilling and something that brings us, you know, a sense of purpose in life, but also because, you know, folks need that second income in order to pay their bills and get by.
But you know, let me ask you, that's interesting. That makes absolute sense to me. But let me just ask you kind of the chicken and the egg question. Did women begin to going into the workforce and working more regularly, earning more money, did that increase what was considered to be middle class essentials because there was more disposable income?
So it's a great question, and there are folks who would argue either side of it. The data, depending on how you, how you break that
you're
down,
not gonna, you're not going to have
different.
Any problem getting your dissertation passed. That's a classic.
But I will say, I think there are certain things like the cost of healthcare, housing right. costs, the cost of education, saving to be able to send your kids to college. Those are costs that have gone up very, very dramatically over the last generation, independent of changes in the labor force. But it is an interesting question. We know that wages have stagnated over the last 30 years or so, too. And so there are some people who argue that part of that wage stagnation has been due to women's entry into the labor force. When you have more people available to work, you can pay a little bit less, because you have a larger labor pool. I think it's a mixed bag there. There's a lot more going on than just saying it's because of women starting to work more.
So let me just ask a question in a very unsophisticated way. But do women get paid the same as men?
Generally speaking, and if we look at all women compared to all men,
right.
No, absolutely okay. not. The exact figures differ depending on how you slice the data. But
right.
the way that I like to talk about it, and that I think is actually really useful, is to compare all women who work full-time year-round to all men who work full-time
year-round.
Oh,
I like that. That's good.
The folks who work part-time, we'll cut those out of the equation for
okay.
right now. And what we find is if you look at all women compared to all men, and this is working in different types of jobs,
right.
certainly, and living in different places, but women earn about 79% of what men earn. And what some people say to me when they argue back about this is, well, okay, but the men and women hold different jobs. Even when you're working full-time, men are more likely to put in extremely long work hours where they're working 50, 60 hours a week. Men, even though women have more education overall than men do, women are more likely to go to college, more likely to go to graduate school. They major in different things, right? So, these are choices. This is what some people will argue to me. These are choices that people are making. Women are choosing to go into these low-paid fields and, not to work 60-hour weeks, et cetera. And my argument back is that if we see these really broad patterns across all women, then there's got to be a lot more going on than just personal choice. And so my argument and my response to that is that there are a number of factors, both in how we run our workplaces and in the types of labor policies that we have as a nation, that even when women are working in large numbers, still push them into particular lines of work and make it really hard for women who have families, especially, to maintain a high level of engagement with work at the same time that they're facing, family caregiving responsibilities. And so those are also societal and policy factors that influence the wages that men and women earn.
We're speaking with Sarah Jane Glynn, who is the director of Women's Economic Policy under the Center for American Progress. And from my judgment, she's a sociologist who actually speaks English. Thank you so much, because what you're saying is really kind of clear and good and easy to understand. So
I'm glad.
So now let me ask you this, because I saw something which kind of says that, and I don't know how they figure this stuff out, but that women spend 47 minutes more a day caring for kids than men, and they spend 41.4 minutes more doing household activities than men. Does that gel with what your information is?
Yes. And so that's one of the points that is really interesting, and I'm so glad you brought it up, because if you look at how men and women spend their time, we know that men spend more time at work, doing
okay.
work that they get paid for,
right?
It's part of the reason why men have higher wages. But when you factor in the types of work that women do that they don't get paid for, things like housework and taking care of children, also taking care of other family members, aging relatives
right.
or anyone else who might need
yeah.
care, then women do just as much, if not more, work. They just aren't getting a paycheck for all of it.
I mean, I can tell you a precise example of a situation I had at work in the past couple of weeks. Somebody in a family, there was a family member who had, medical emergency that needed to be dealt with. And it was obvious that it was the woman who was going to kind of take off work to care for the person, et cetera, in a very caring, wonderful way. But it almost was assumed that that was the woman's job, even though, quite frankly, in this situation, the woman would, according to societal thing, probably have a higher job than the man.
Well, and we know from surveys that that's true, that when there's a family member who needs care, it's usually the woman who's the one who does it. So whether that's mom taking time off to care for a sick child, or an adult daughter who's taking time off to care for her parents and, you know, taking an aging parent to a doctor's appointment or something like that, it is usually women who do that type of work. And it's really unfortunate for a lot of reasons, but, you know, part of what I have always found really troubling around this is not just that it places a lot of expectations on women, but also, you know, that we haven't really created a lot of space, and we haven't really created good workplace cultures that allow men to do those things too.
Yep.
And, you know, increasingly with younger millennial men, what we're finding is that they report really wanting to be involved with their families. They want to be able to have more time to spend with their kids and with their parents, but it's very hard for them to have to find that flexibility with their employers. So, you know, it is very much a women's issue in the way that it plays out right now.
Yeah.
But I think it's also very much a men's issue. And I'm really encouraged that there are so many more men's voices that we're hearing around these issues, where you have men who are saying, well, actually, we need paid parental leave so we can be home with our new babies too. Or we need this flexibility that will let us take our kids to their dentist appointments and go to their soccer games and, you know, be part of our families in the way that we have historically enabled women to. But we haven't really created much space for men to do those things too.
I think that's an incredibly good point. And I think one of the things hard to deal with is some of the subtle things. And even where there are organizations which understand that and kind of encourage people to do that and are flexible with regard to, you know, allowing people to do those things, there's a subtle way, I think, probably that, you know, the people who work longer hours, who are there, are kind of perceived to be better employees and probably get promotions and raises more than others.
And we do know that that's true, looking at data and interviews with employers. But I think there is starting to be a shift. You know, I was really heartened to see that we are experiencing this shift. And we know that there are more and more men who are not only asking for these policies, but that are actually taking them as well. You know, and every time that we have a high profile baseball player who ends up taking paternity leave and missing a few games so that he can be with his wife when she gives birth. Or every time that, you know, someone like Zuckerberg from Facebook actually takes his paternity leave and says, no, I'm going to spend this time at home with my family.
Somebody who's got worth, it just came out yesterday, I think $40 billion. can take paternity leave for the rest of his life. So let's not use Zuckerberg.
But I think it sets a precedent for people who work in his company. You know, I'm not worried about his finances.
Right.
He's fine. But to be able to say this, there's a culture within our workplace where it's acceptable for workers to actually take this time off, I think that's what's really valuable there.
Yeah.
Because we need to see a shift in our mindset and our behaviors too. It doesn't do us any good to have policies on the books if people don't feel they can actually access them.
You know, let me, in one thing which I just put out there is I think at least we've made some advances in this area. It does seem to me today that, let's just assume you have a man and a woman who are graduates from the same law school, and they become an associate at a firm. My opinion would be that in this day and age, they probably do get offered at least the same starting salary.
So, unfortunately, that's often not the case. And if you look, I mean, case in individual scenarios, it may look different. But, you know, if you take sort of the broad view of it, Women are less likely to negotiate their starting salaries when they get that first job after they leave school.
Right.
And even when women do negotiate their starting salaries, they usually end up with worse offers than men do. And this is something, you know, that I personally have experienced in my own life, too. Years and years ago, negotiating salaries at jobs when I was finishing school, you know, I would talk to my colleagues later and find out, even though I had been pushing, these folks who, you know, had on paper looked exactly like me, ended up being able to negotiate higher salaries. And part of it was because when women negotiate, it's viewed very, very differently than men do.
Okay.
And so, you know, I think we are seeing advances, but unfortunately, we haven't reached parity. And I would argue that this is one of the reasons why, you know, we really need to have public policies to help address some of these things. And, you know, there have been efforts that have been made to enact policies to promote greater pay transparency and also to prohibit employers from asking about previous wages when they're setting salaries for new jobs in order to try to combat this, right? Because if you start out your career at a disadvantage, that can become compounded over time. And so there are a lot of folks who are trying to think creatively about how we can pass public policies at both the state and the federal level to try to roll some of this back and create a more level playing field.
That'd be interesting. And you know, after you get your doctorate, maybe you come back, we talk more about that, because some of that can, in the real world, as good as it seems, sometimes backfires and it becomes counterproductive. So I'd love to discuss that more with you. And thanks so much for taking the time to be with us. I found it delightful, and I'm sure our listeners learned a whole lot more about what is a critically important issue. So, Sarah, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Sarah James Glidden, Director of Women's Economic Policy under the Center for American Progress. So thank you for being with us on Just Love, Women's History Must. We discuss the issue of pay and gender equality. Please, thanks for being with us, and join us again next week when we come back on Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.